This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Welcome to the show, everyone. This is Aaron Harris, and you are tuning into the Football Odyssey. My guest today is John Davis, host of For the Good of the Game podcast, as well as an Army veteran, a longtime youth football coach, and currently the director of field operations for the Upstart Developmental League, Major League Football. John and I have an in-depth conversation on his football journey from his playing days as a young man to his post-Army career as a coach and as a recruiter for the Army All-American game to his involvement in Major League Football and his podcast. Make sure to click the links in the description to check out John's podcast and the webpage for MLFB. And feel free to subscribe, share, and rate this podcast. That said, hope you all enjoy this conversation. And now, here is John Davis. All right, John, thanks for taking the time to come on the show. How are you this evening?
I'm doing great, Aaron. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. You and I had the chance to meet finally last week talking about Major League Football, and we'll get on to that later on in our conversation. But in talking with you, it was apparent to me that you've lived a full life within football, and it's been a big part of your life ever since you were a young man. So I think it would be good to start the conversation early in your life and kind of get a sense. Did you grow up in a football crazy family, or was this something that you kind of adopted as you got older?
No, it was, I won't say my folks were necessarily football crazy. I mean, my dad grew up in Chattanooga, Tennessee, really didn't have a sports background. My mom was a high school cheerleader. So, you know, I mean, it was kind of one of those things they grew into. But I had three other siblings, and all of us at one time or another played sports. I just happened to, my brother and I, who's 5 years my junior, we just took a liking to it. So I started playing football when I was in third grade. And we were living in Birmingham, Alabama, and started tackle football then and continued all the way through my freshman year of college and actually dropped out and transferred before I joined the military. So, yeah, it was a lifelong pursuit. But much as I believe today, I also am a huge proponent of being a multi-sport athlete. And in addition to that, you know, I played baseball up until high school. I ran track all up through high school, played summer track, tennis, never did soccer. Just wasn't a thing when I was, I'm 63 years old, so it wasn't real big back then. But yeah, so it probably one of the neatest memories I have regarding family football is we grew up in a huge Dallas Cowboys fan family. And one of the companies my dad had, he had an RV as a company perk that he would loan out. And on Thanksgivings, back when the Cowboys would play the Redskins, now the Washington Commanders or whatever they are, every Thanksgiving, my mom would make Thanksgiving dinner the night before, and we would go down to the stadium and parking lot and tailgate, eat Thanksgiving dinner, and then go in to watch the game. So that was pretty cool.
You played quarterback when you were younger, right? All the way through college.
Yeah, it was kind of crazy when I was younger. Up until probably a couple of years before high school, I was, you know, as big or bigger than everybody I played with. But when I got into high school, I mean, if it gives any context to it, my freshman year of college football, I was 5'10 and a half, weighed 151 pounds. And I mean, I was like one of the smallest guys on the team. So for whatever reason, I kind of gravitated toward quarterback. I started out playing running back and defensive back when I was younger, and then kind of gravitated toward the offensive side of the ball. And, you know, like all kids, I guess I enjoyed being in that position where, you know, you got to handle the ball every play and that kind of thing. And I tell people all the time, I've said it repeatedly on my podcast, the foundations for leadership and teamwork that I developed that carried me through my military career for 23 years were developed playing football.
This might sound like an obvious question, seeing as you're a Cowboys fan and you played quarterback for a good part of your playing career, but was Roger Staubach your idol growing up?
Yeah, he really was. In fact, I wore number 12 in high school because of him. Oh, yeah. And it's funny. I shared this with one of our Sports History Network teammates recently, but we were one of my sisters and Roger's daughter, Jennifer, were in I was a dance class of some sort, ballet or something together. So my mom knew her and they would carpool periodically. And we were out driving around one time and the Staubachs lived at that time. They lived several miles from where we did. It was in a more upscale neighborhood than I lived in, but we were driving around. And as we came kind of down this residential street, it was either ball or frisbee came out in front of the car and somebody darted out to get it. My dad had to slam the brakes on. And, the guy grabbed the object and looked up and looked back at us and kind of waved and then ran back in the yard. And it was Roger Staubach. He had been out playing with the kids. And my dad took a deep breath. He had his hands on the wheel and he took a deep breath, hadn't even let his foot off the brake yet. And he sighed and he goes, "Can you imagine being the guy in Dallas, Texas, who ran over Roger Staubach?" He goes, "I'd have been dead before the next game." I talked to my dad about that even in his later days. He passed away in December, but I talked about that. And he had a fond memory, even though at the time it wasn't, that thing. So anyway, it was, yeah, Staubach was my favorite. When my youngest son was getting ready to play college football, we visited New Mexico Military Institute. And they have a little shrine to Staubach set up there because he went to NEMI before he went to the Naval Academy. So it was kind of neat to see my son watch the football practice and then worked out with the baseball team. He was a two-sport athlete. And he ended up not going there, but it was cool that we got to see, the little museum that they have and see the little thing with Roger's jersey and helmet and stuff. That was neat.
How would you describe Roger's playing style to some of the younger fans who never got to saw him play?
I would say he was kind of not in terms of his size, but as far as his athletic ability, there was only one other quarterback in his era, in my opinion. I'm sure some sports history buff will call me on this, but the two guys that I remember being as elusive as they were Roger Staubach and Fran Tarkenton, who played for the Minnesota Vikings. And Roger's style was one of pass first and run second, but he was so gifted. And I think so many players, especially his first few years in the league, underestimated his athleticism. And he just had this uncanny knack, almost like eyes in the back of his head. I mean, for being able to elude tacklers, even when he didn't necessarily see them, he had this sense, sixth sense of feeling the pressure. So I think that he was, his leadership certainly came through. And that may have been a little bit, coming from the Naval Academy and having been in Vietnam, even though he was a junior officer then. But I would say probably his style was, he was kind of had a little bit of a gunslinger in him, kind of that old school Brett Favre type thing, even though Brett played way after him. And definitely had a knack for evading tacklers. So it was a very elusive style, although he had a great arm, probably not the strongest in the league by any means, but it was just that kind of, he was almost kind of a run and shoot guy before, any kind of run and shoot offense was ever developed.
Yeah, it's good that you brought up his athleticism, because when you go from where he was at the Naval Academy to running pretty much as was as he was passing, maybe if not more so. And Tom Landry has mentioned early in his career how Roger was always looking to run first before he threw the ball. And it's amazing how he was able to adapt in a passing game that was very complex under Tom Landry.
Yeah, it was not an easy transition. And I was speaking a minute ago more toward the end of his career. And of course, he had to retire because of concussions, and he ran less toward the end than he did up front. But you're right. And it was tough because Coach Landry was so – I mean, I don't think – to be honest with you, I don't think someone with the same style of Tom Landry would be successful in today's NFL because it's a different style of players. I mean, we're the league is almost growing with the generation of players and growing the coaching staffs in line with that. When you see guys like Sean McVay and some of the other young coaches, I don't think Landry's my way or the highway style would really fly today. I mean, Ellie, even when who was it? San Francisco. I can't remember. When they hired the old Mike Singletary, when they hired Mike Singletary as head coach, he had that kind of autocratic style of coaching, and it didn't fly well with a lot of the players. So, you know, but it was playing for, I've heard Staubach talk about it very candidly, playing for Landry, especially early on, was not fun. I mean, it was, he disagreed with the coach a lot.
Yeah. I've heard a lot of players had a hard time kind of getting with his cold, detached style, you know, because obviously people from that era will remember Vince Lombardi screaming his lungs out on the sideline, but he was also sort of like this father figure to a lot of the players, that tough love stigma, whereas Tom was kind of like the cold, calculated scientist, just putting X's and O's and inserting players. So yeah, there were definitely people I think that had a lot of varying opinions of the man, certainly. But like,
well, the fact that they, you know, put a statue up to him and the way that, you know, Jerry Jones handled the whole thing when he let him go was kind of a travesty, but it just seemed like it was kind of disrespectful in my opinion. And that's, I think a lot of people who aren't Cowboys fans would say that same thing, but you know, it's a business of business. So, you know, sometimes it is what it is.
Now, being that you were a multi-sport athlete growing up, like what did football teach you about yourself that you don't think you were discovered playing the other sports?
It was probably on a leadership development level was the biggest thing was, you know, when I was a commander or in positions to lead soldiers in the Army, one of the things that I talked about a lot was among peers was that I didn't feel that a leader should ask his soldiers to do anything that he wouldn't do. And what I found early on, one of the things I started doing my senior year of high school is, you know, being a smaller guy, I wasn't going to run out and, you know, grab a lineman's face mask and chew him out for not blocking somebody. It wasn't my style. I might be angry at him, but what I started doing was I got my coach to allow me to do all my warmups pre-individual period with the lineman. So whatever they were doing, I did. And if they were doing blocking drills, I was going up against them. And it kind of reinforced to me because I began to see a little bit of a change in the relationship with the guys who played on the offensive line in that, you know, I kind of earned their respect a little bit. And that made a big impression on me because I was, you know, I think everyone has to lead from within. There are rah-rah guys, which I was, and there are very quiet, almost just super humble leaders too. I don't feel like I was an egomaniac by any means, but I was a very vocal leader. I mean, I was always cheering guys on, patting them on the butt, way to go, you know, that kind of thing. And a lot of guys, they just show up, they have all their gear, they're on time, they do everything they have to do, they might do a little extra, and that's how they lead. But for me, it reinforced the leadership aspect and really being able to develop relationships and with the new project I'm working on, Changing Youth Sports long-term, that's one of the big things I want to try to reinforce because I think it's so valuable. I think that a lot of kids in youth sports don't see themselves as leaders. And it's because they have typically seen at the college or NFL level, you know, guys like Baker Mayfield or Cam Newton, who stood out in college, were very vocal, stood out in the pros, and they say that's not me. But there are many kids, many people that are very well-respected leaders that are not out front yell at the team kind of guy. So I think that's probably the lessons. I mean, it really kind of, in a very shallow way, at the beginning, kind of reinforced and helped develop my leadership skills as much as anything else.
Do you recall, looking back, one particular game or maybe practice where you really had to step up and become that leader, that sort of coming of age moment that really aided your development?
I do. As a matter of fact, it's kind of funny. I do a Friday morning Zoom Bible study with about 20 or 30 guys, depending on the day, that I went to high school with. And it's really comical to hear, you know, us jaw back and forth and stuff. And several of the guys in that group were on my football team. And we've talked about some of the stuff that went on. But when I was I played high school football at J.J. Pierce High School in Richardson, Texas. And Richardson High School was our arch rival. And to the point when I graduated in 1977, Pierce had never beaten Richardson at the varsity level. And I think it was my junior year, we were playing the JV game, and I had been battling for starting quarterback position and got inserted with about 3 minutes left in the first half. And the third or fourth play we ran, I threw a 47-yard touchdown pass to a guy named Danny Hudson. Not that I remember the details or anything, but it's one of those things where, you know, and I use that story when I talk to parents about, I believe every kid, regardless of age, deserves their 15 minutes of fame. You know, it doesn't matter if they're 7 years old playing flag football or they're 18 years old playing high school football. So many kids that end their sports careers never have a seminal moment that they can look back on and say, wow, that was really cool for me, you know? And it's not about, and like I say, it's not an ego thing. It's just have a fond memory of what you put into the sport. And that night we went on to beat Richardson, albeit it was a JV game, not varsity. And I got a little bit of notoriety, and it was kind of really the first time when, you know, the kids would all go to the local Pizza Inn and have pizza after the game. And I was kind of the big man on campus that night. So, and what it drove home to me was in the second half, that pass occurred right before the halftime, is in the second half, the guys seemed to respond to me a little different. And it was like, hey, you know, you got in there and got the job done. Now let's go finish this game. And they were more receptive to my leadership style of cheering them on and encouraging them. And I could see that coming on. And that really helped me, you know, the following year going into my senior season. So,
well, a moment like that can really provide encouragement for someone, obviously, who really needs it. But I think in any capacity can give someone that confidence to come out of their shell. Or, you know, if there's someone who, you know, has confidence, it can reaffirm what they're doing to inspire other people too.
Yeah, no doubt. And I see it, you know, a lot of times and as a coach, what I've learned is you've really got to look for those moments. All too often, I think as coaches, we tend to see the things kids don't do. And what you have to do, I think sometimes, is find the things that they do, maybe when they're not even expecting it. And make a big deal of it and congratulate them when they have been working hard on a particular block or a certain aspect or skill, you know, of the game, and they get it, you know, make sure you pump them up. And too often we're so, you know, we lean so much toward giving them crap when they don't do well or yelling at them when they, you know, struggle. And I think sometimes I'm a big believer in discipline. And I really think that, you know, tough love is an appropriate way of teaching accountability and responsibility. But I also think that encouragement, much more than criticism, is the way to go. And I would agree with you. I think that and not just in sports, although it's great when it is in sports, but a lot of times, you know, that can happen in the office or in somebody in the band or math club or whatever. I mean, it could happen in a number of roles in life.
Yeah, it's just about finding what makes a person tick. In terms Absolutely. Of, you said something about rivalries. It makes me think of something I want to ask. Have you ever heard of the greatest comeback that never was? It was a high school championship between Plano East and, God, I don't remember the name of the other school. I want to say it was a private school, but It was in the 90s where Plano East had almost erased, I think, like a 31, maybe a 35 point deficit.
I do not remember the exact circumstances, but I have watched that highlight video. Yes. And I can't for the life of me.
I need to look this up because this was a huge, it was almost a comeback. And for those people who don't know what I'm talking about, I'll post the clip in the description, but Plano East was playing in a championship game where they were down. John Tyler was the school.
Yeah.
Yeah. 1994.
And they came back and scored a remarkable amount of points in a very short period of time and then fell short at the end.
Yeah, it was 1994, John Tyler versus Plano East. I don't see what division it was, but at the very end of the game, after Plano East had taken the lead, John Tyler ran back a touchdown for the, yeah, it was 5A. And then John Tyler had ran back a kick return for a touchdown to crush their spirits, essentially.
Yeah, those types of losses are heartbreaking. And, you know, they're great if you're on the winning side, but when when you're coaching or playing on a team that comes up short after giving what they certainly would think would be their all, but one thing I've learned, Aaron, I've been on a real strict personal development mission for the past 3.5-4 years. And, you know, too many times I think nowadays in society, particularly in sports and even more so in football, parents tend to focus on the outcome, you know, and I understand coaches get paid to win games and winning records, get more jobs and make more money and all that kind of stuff. But in my opinion, the outcomes are not the important part. It's who you become in the process of trying to achieve the outcome. So whether the outcome is a win or loss, you know, I used to teach my kids growing up, you either win or you learn. And when you lose on the scoreboard, there are opportunities, usually plural, to improve yourself or your team. And, I think that, again, a lot of that goes back to relationships. I was interviewing Coach Robert Ford, who was the tight ends coach through all three of the Cowboys Super Bowl runs back in the day when they had the triplets. And Coach Ford's big thing was, he said, you know, if you can have a relationship to where you can coach a player's heart, that you can not only have a pretty good football player, but you can have a pretty good football team. And I think going back to what we just mentioned about Tom Landry, sometimes his style was more mechanical, very unemotional, and even sometimes ruthless, but it was effective because he had great talent. Whereas a guy like, I'll say Sean McVay. I don't know how he is, but a lot of the younger coaches seem to be very much into the relationships with their players. And with today's athletes, that tends to prompt, I think, more effort and desire when you have that relationship where they know you got their back.
As far as your career in the military, I mean, how did you originally end up joining? Was this something that you had always wanted to do your whole life, or was there something in life that made it a necessity?
I wouldn't say necessarily a necessity, but I was a very immature 18 and 19 year old. And the exact way this happened was my dad was not, and I was too young to, I mean, back then the legal drinking age was 18. Mm-hmm. And I was 19 living at home, and my dad and I were sitting on the back porch having a beer. And I tell people all the time, I joke about it. He said, have you ever thought about joining the military? And I tell people what I heard him say was, why don't you get the hell out of my house? And it never was like that. In fact, there wasn't a human being walking the earth that was any prouder of me than my father. I mean, he had done a few years in the National Guard, and my mom's father was a retired colonel who was in the Army for 28 years. And on my mom's side of the family, there were also two other, an Air Force colonel and a Navy captain. So there was some pretty, you know, senior leadership in our family. I had dropped out of college twice, just really didn't have any direction in life. And I joined the military, and all of that foundation of leadership that I learned doing sports, and particularly football, kind of came to bear when I joined the military, and I enlisted as an infantry soldier, and then was very fortunate to be selected to go to Officer Candidate School after a couple of years in the military. And I transitioned to become an infantry officer, and ended up retiring after 23 years. And, really fully enjoyed. I mean, everybody's career has points that aren't great, that suck, you know, for whatever reason, whether it's physical, mental, or whatever. But it was a great way to raise a family. And I think going back to your original question, that it may have been almost kind of a quiet desperation. And then at my dad's suggestion, going down, and I actually took the test, the ASVAB. Some people may know what that is. A lot of kids take it now in high school. I took the ASVAB for the Navy, and I scored really high on it. And they wanted me to go in to be a submariner. I just didn't seem to see him.
What is the test?
It's the ASVAB, the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery.
Okay.
And it basically grades you. It's kind of like the Wonderlic for the NFL. You know, it kind of gives them a sense of where your mechanical and reasoning skills are, what kind of education you have, and so on. And I was just fortunate to score real high on it. And the Navy had offered me going in to being a submariner. And I always thought it was pronounced submariner, but one of my Navy buddies corrected me. I didn't see that. So I wanted to do something that was fun and exciting and physical. I mean, I'd always been an athlete. And as I joke with my kids, by the time I got in the military, I was at that point in my athletic career where the older I get, the better I was. So I joined the Army and continued to do a lot of competitive sports in the military. But it was more of a quiet desperation, I think, to answer your question. It just turned out to be the right thing for me.
Did you join with the anticipation that you would spend 25 years with the Army or with
no,
the military?
Not really. I don't know. You know, I signed a contract to go to the Ranger Regiment and become an Airborne Ranger. And I saw that as probably the coolest outward facing, you know, special ops kind of thing that I could do that I knew about at the time. And as it turned out, I did not go to Ranger Regiment. I did, however, become an Airborne Ranger, and I spent 7 years of my career in the 82nd Airborne Division and became a jump master and a master parachutist. And all of those things together factored into me having what I would call, a very exciting and rewarding career. So it was a lot of fun.
I had a roommate when I was in my senior year of college, my last semester. He was a little bit older than me, but he was a vet that had done a couple tours in Afghanistan. And he used to tell me that he could spot a veteran just by the way they walked. Was he pulling my leg, or can you attest to that?
You know, it's really funny. I think I get a little sense of that when I'm out in public. But what's really weird is I have never thought of myself in that light on the receiving end. But I have had more times when I've had people at the gym or in a store or something come up to me and say, "Are you a veteran, or were you in the Army?" And I say, it's the way you carry yourself. So maybe there is some truth to it, you know, the way they walk. I mean, in my case, being an infantry guy and doing a whole lot of road marches and breaking my body down, I tend to walk just naturally now. I tend to walk leaning forward and almost a little bit hunched over. And some of that's poor posture, and some of it's out of force of habit. So, yeah, I think you can. I think a lot of times you can. Maybe it's a way that people carry themselves. I think for folks who are proud of their service, and there are some that aren't, unfortunately, I think you tend to reflect that. You kind of, you know, I mean, when I'm at a sporting event and the flag is, you know, raised or the national anthem's played, even if I'm in civilian clothes, I still salute, which I'm authorized to do. So I think sometimes people can tell, yeah.
When you were in the military, did you still follow football closely? I know you said you did competitive stuff while you were in the military. I mean, did you facilitate or organize any football games for anyone in your squadron? Like, was that something to build a camaraderie?
Yeah. When I was younger, several of the units I was in, I actually played, I generally would play quarterback because we were always passing and I didn't have to run as much. As I got older, that was a bigger deal. But we had one year, we had a kid that that was just, I mean, he could have been a Division I quarterback. He should have been, but he was very patriotic and joined the military right out of high school. Didn't ever entertain going to college. But yeah, I played competitively. Usually it was flag in the military just for, you know, sanity and from keeping guys from getting hurt too bad. I mean, they did have a mission to do, so you didn't want people beating themselves up on the but I found other ways to stay competitive. Like even when I was a young platoon leader in the 82nd Airborne, I would challenge my guys and I would say, hey, if you beat me on when we do a physical fitness test, a PT test, if you beat me on one event, I'll give you a day off. And if you beat me on the entire score, I'll give you a 3-day pass. Wow. And it kept me sharp. And I never got beat on the whole score, but I had a kid in my platoon that would regularly run around 10:18 to 10:30 in the 2 mile. And he was a deer. I mean, so I would lose to him, but I mean, when I had kids, the natural thing for me was, and of course, a lot of people who are parents now know, you know, oftentimes you get roped into coaching because there aren't enough coaches and you either volunteer or get drafted based on coaching a team your child plays on. And I started coaching my oldest son in youth sports on Fort Bragg when I was in the 82nd. And I ended up coaching all four of my children who are now, the youngest is 28, oldest is 35. I coached all four of them in every sport they played up through and including high school when I was not deployed. So I accumulated a total of just over 20 years of coaching youth sports up through high school. And in some cases that was multiple seasons within a year, but it was primarily baseball and football. So yeah, I stayed connected to the game. I ran the NFL's junior player development program in Kentucky for 5 years before they did away with it. So I was running full contact camps for the local kids. The last 2 years, we had 118 kids in the camp each year. And that was a 3-week long full contact camp. And then I got involved with, you know, through the All-American Games and the U.S. Army All-American Bowl in running camps and stuff. So, yeah, I stayed very connected to the game the whole time I was in the military.
Yeah, that's interesting how you use the game to keep the boys in shape and kind of keep spirits up. Like, have you ever done a deep dive into like the World War II military service teams? Anything like that about how they had, you know, sort of they would have guys stationed at different schools and they would have games that they would play against actual university teams? Or if people were stationed overseas, like in England or Japan, they would put military games on mainly for the boys, but they would have spectators come and kind of see this game that was completely foreign to them. Have you ever looked into that?
I haven't done a deep dive, but I'm aware of it and have read some of the history of that. And it's really kind of interesting because what you find is that if you look back at the degree of talent that they had on some of those teams, and I remember the only reason I bring this up is because it was shared with me by someone who did the deep dive, mm-hmm. in that some of those military teams had as much talent as any Division I school and they're starting 11 players, depending on, you know, who you looked at. And a lot of times it was because, you know, even post-World War II, it was because you had guys join the military. Following every war, there's always, it tends to be a patriotic surge. You know, there was a huge patriotic surge after 9/11, even though that wasn't a war. So you get a lot of these guys that might have gone on to play or did play a year or two of college ball, enlisting in the Army or joining through ROTC and being field commissioned. And they would be tremendous athletes. And I don't know how actively they do that kind of thing anymore now, but yeah, it was a serious thing. As a matter of fact, when I got to Fort Benning, there was at one time a very popular, wildly popular, semi-pro football team on Fort Benning made up of completely of soldiers. It was called the Fort Benning Doughboys, and Doughboy Stadium was still there when I got there in 1982 to go through basic. And we used to go do PT in that stadium. And it was dilapidated by that time. It wasn't a big, you know, it wasn't like the Rose Bowl, but they actually had a team at Fort Benning for years that was very competitive.
And they would play against like teams in that region, other semi-pro teams.
They do semi-pro and they would sometimes play college teams as well.
Wow. That's fascinating. Yeah. I think Paul Brown and Weeb Eubank actually got their, I don't know if it was a coaching start, but they coached, I think, the Great Lakes Naval Academy. before they made the jump to the NFL. So that's interesting to hear. Was there a commanding officer that you had that left the biggest impact on you by the time you had left the military?
You know, it's interesting. I had a couple that were very instrumental, but probably the guy that left the single biggest impression on me from a leadership standpoint was at the time was a lieutenant colonel. He was my battalion commander in the 82nd. His name was Buck Kernan. And he had been a platoon leader in Vietnam in the Ranger Regiment. He eventually, when he made full colonel, became the Ranger Regimental Commander, and he retired as a 4-star. And he was very impactful in terms of giving me opportunities that other guys in my position had not received before. So I don't know whether he saw something in me, or maybe I had done just enough right things to earn those. Colonel Kernan, in fact, I started checking in a couple of weeks ago to see if I know he had been sick, and I'm not sure he's still around, but I would love, my wife knows his wife. And it's not like we were, you know, we weren't post-retirement best friends or anything, but he had a great impact on me. He was, even as an older guy, as a lieutenant colonel, a senior lieutenant colonel, he was exceptionally physically fit. His leadership style was, he was hardcore, but very soft-spoken. He was a team builder kind of guy. And that's the way I lead. I've always been a team builder. I've never been like an autocratic type leader. Interestingly, though, I mean, when you look at some of the guys that are in the news right now, you know, if you watch Fox News for 5 minutes and they're talking about Ukraine, you'll see Lieutenant General retired Keith Kellogg, who was the 82nd Airborne Division commander when I was there, and Lieutenant General retired, or General retired Jack Keane, who was the Corps commander when I was there. And I had a chance to meet and be in the room with those guys, and not directly influence my career in any way, but just to see their leadership style and stuff. So, yeah, there were a lot, but I would say Colonel Kernan was probably one of the single most impactful guys.
Yeah, and that what he said, or what you said about him seeing something in you, possibly, that kind of alludes to what we were talking about earlier about people having kind of like that 15 minutes of fame that can lead to encouragement.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. I think you alluded to this earlier too about coaching your son whenever you were in the military, but do you remember your first coaching job when you took a job coaching football?
Yeah, it was almost kind of weird. My oldest son, who at the time was, I want to say 9, I coached. I discount this because my two oldest boys decided to play indoor soccer, and I knew nothing about soccer. I still don't, although I've learned to appreciate the game a lot more as an adult. When I was coaching football as a younger guy, I used to call soccer a communist sport. And when I had a chance as an adult to really sit down and really watch the World Cup, it just brought out what a phenomenally, I see why they call it the beautiful game. I mean, it's really just some tremendous athletes. Anyway, I started coaching, but the first few teams were kind of, it wasn't as impactful to me personally. The first time it really made a big difference for me was when I coached my oldest son. He had gone to try out. He had never played tackle football, and he was trying out for the middle school team on Fort Bragg. And the coach made it very clear to the parents that I didn't like this, but I understood it. He said, I've only got 30 sets of equipment. I am going to have 2 days of practice, and at the end of the practice, I'm going to select the 30 kids I think can help us win. And generally, that means the 30 kids who hit the hardest. So my son was just getting started, and as a lot of kids do, he was a little intimidated by the contact initially. He did okay. He didn't have a bad 2 days, but he didn't get picked up. And just in case, I had gone over and registered him with Child Youth Services to play tackle football in the rec league, just in case he didn't make the middle school team. So I ended up coaching his team, and it was several other guys. And it was a Pop Warner league on Fort Bragg. And, you know, that's every, I think every father or mother that starts out coaching, you always have a tendency to coach your own child harder than you do other kids. In fact, I've had a lot of parents tell me, well, I could never coach my own kid because I couldn't do that. To me, that was my quality time, especially being in the military and being gone as much as I was. That was my quality time with my kids. So that season was very impactful. I learned a lot about, probably more about myself than I did about coaching in general, you know, and I made mistakes. You know, I remember one game, my son made a stupid mistake and I called timeout, walked down the field in the middle of the huddle, grabbed his face mask and started chewing him out. And he almost shut down on me. I mean, you know, and it was a totally wrong way to handle it. Wouldn't matter what kid it was, but it was even worse with my own child. I embarrassed him. It doesn't mean you can't be hard on a kid. Doesn't mean you can't have them try to reach to achieve a standard, but I learned more about myself that season probably than any other time. So the single year where I learned the most was in the year 2000 when we got to Fort Bragg. My oldest son was a freshman in high school, was playing at Fort Knox. Fort Knox had one of the four Department of Defense high schools still left in the United States, and they still do. So my oldest son was playing high school ball. My middle son was playing rec league baseball. My youngest son and my daughter were playing flag football. Mm-hmm. And so that fall, 2020, I coached three football teams. I was the volunteer defensive coordinator for the freshman team at the high school. I coached a 10 to 12 year old tackle team and a 7 to 9 year old flag team. So I was doing, on some days of the week, I was doing 5 to 6 hours of football practice after being in the Army and working all day. And
this was in 2000.
That was in 2000. And that's where I started coaching before that. But in 2000, it's when I brought it all to bear. And I was real fortunate to be in a job where I had I was in a staff job where I had the opportunity to leave the office at the same time every day, as opposed to being in an infantry unit when you might be, you know, in the office till 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And, you know, it was, I have as many fond memories of that year, but I busted my butt that whole fall because of all the different dynamics going on.
But now sitting in that year, right, where you're coaching three different age groups, I mean, do you approach your coaching philosophy or do you implement your coaching philosophy the same way for all age groups? Or do you kind of have to adjust it based on which demographic you're dealing with?
The philosophy stays the same. Although I will tell you in 2000, I didn't have a written coaching philosophy, and that's something I do now. As a matter of fact, I'll email you that just so you can see it. But my coaching style is really about teaching life skills. And so my coaching philosophy didn't change from age to age, but I tried to mold my approach to an age appropriate style of coaching. So within my own coaching philosophy, you know, when I was dealing with 7 to 9 year olds, I'm certainly not going to drill them in the same way or come down on them in the same way I would, you know, a freshman in high school. And the 9 to 10 year olds were just learning how to tackle. So it was all about, you know, technique and trying to get them over the fear of being hit or hitting someone. You know, I've shared so many times with parents, you can take an aggressive kid and teach them how to play football or any contact sport, but you can't coach aggression into a child. So a lot of parents, you know, dads want their son to be the football stud, and their son at that stage in his life is just not into that. And it frustrates a lot of parents. And I'll include moms in that. I mean, I know a lot of moms that are football fanatics. And so I think you have to adjust your style. Your philosophy should stay the same, but your style should adapt to the age appropriate level that you're coaching.
Yeah, it definitely feels like that could be a pain having to deal with the parents who want their kid to be somebody that they're not quite there yet.
It is. It's, you know, I found though, Aaron, that, you know, I could almost always avoid hassles and heartaches by communicating. I mean, when I used to start every season with a team meeting, and I would have a contract for the parents to sign and a contract for the kids to sign. And it was very informal, but it laid out how we're going to do this. Parent and coach work together as a team. You know, every time report cards came out, I want to see the report card. If there's something that's going on at the house with a discipline issue and you need me to reinforce some discipline, I'm happy to do that. Conversely, if your child's misbehaving in at practice, I'm going to come back to you and let you know, those kinds of things. So dealing with parents isn't it's the boon of most, or the bane, I should say, of most youth coaches. But many of the conflicts and issues can be avoided by great communication. And unfortunately, a lot of coaches, particularly new coaches, don't necessarily invest the time in doing that.
Well, I think a lot of coaches too are the guys that just want to be left alone with a blackboard and a marker just to come up with X's and O's. And then the human side of it kind of is something that I think requires a little bit more. You know, you can learn plenty by sitting at a desk and going through YouTube videos or books, learning the schematics and the strategy. But to be able to be good working with people, you have to do it in order to become better at it, certainly.
Well, I agree. And I think that coaches today have a very unique challenge. And when I started out doing season two, in between season one and season two of my podcast, I had some live stream podcasts and we interviewed coaches during COVID. And I think all coaches today, but particularly in football, relevant to what we're talking about, I think that there is an element in coaching young people, particularly at the high school level nowadays, the coaches are dealing with that didn't exist before COVID. And, you know, we've seen a rise in so many different factors of emotional behavior. You know, we've had kids acting out. We've had anxiety and depression spike. We've had suicidal attempts spike. We've had, you know, because everybody was spending so much time like this and, you know, you lost the human connection. I mean, we're social animals and, you know, people want to be around. So I think going forward from 2022 on, there's an element of coaching that all coaches are going to have to realize. And that's, you know, that human interest side. It's if you haven't been a people person before, you're going to have to be now because you've got to be able to connect with every kid on every level. And, you know, some players most coaches know this. Some players respond to aggressive, you know, verbal stimuli. Mm-hmm. Other kids will shut down on you. And I mean, I know, you know, for my own children, my oldest son dealt with me hollering at him very well. My youngest son, the worst thing I could say to him was look at him with an earnest face and say, wow, you know, TD, you really disappointed me today. I didn't have to yell, you know? So I think you've got to be able to connect. You got to have that emotional intelligence enough to connect and understand that every player is different. I have a good friend named Mark Evans, who's the head coach at Manheim Township in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, or just outside of Lancaster. And, you know, he said he's a school counselor and he's been a head coach for over 24 years in two different schools. And he's been very successful. And he said, but if you looked at him, how he coached 20 years ago versus what he does now, his approach to dealing with students as a school counselor is totally different. And as a football coach, totally different. Because he said nowadays, you know, you have a kid come in having a bad day. You know, he said he might have gotten on them before if they were late. Hey, you know, come down on them hard. Nowadays, his first thought is, I wonder if they had breakfast this morning. You know, I wonder how long it's been since somebody told them I love you. And I think that a lot of times nowadays at the high school level and below, coaches have to have that emotional intelligence to be able to read their players a little bit. And I think going back to what I said a minute ago, getting to know the parents helps because you have a lot of kids in single parent homes and so on and so forth. And not everybody's situation is hunky-dory. And you got to be able to sift through that and try to connect with each kid on their level.
Yeah, it's like empathy is attached to the evolution of the position.
Absolutely.
How long have you been coaching in Texas?
Since we moved back, I coached in Texas only during the periods of time that we were here. So I have not actively coached for the last 5 years. I am going to get back into coaching probably at the youth level initially here once MLFB season is over with and we kind of go into year two and see what's going on. And I would very much, I mean, you know, it may sound crazy because at 63, it's not like I've got, you know, half a lifetime ahead of me, but I hope to be around for a few more years. And the ideal situation for my retirement would be to find a little bitty small 1 or 2A school here in Texas somewhere and just spend the rest of my life, you know, teaching young men how to be better citizens. And so I have not coached here in Texas since we've been back I played high school and college ball here, but after joining the military, all of my coaching was in other areas, to include Germany.
Gotcha. Do you know Cody Alexander? He's the defensive coordinator at Mesquite Horn High School.
Actually, no, I've heard his name though.
Yeah, he. I had him on the podcast last March, and he wrote a book about. He's written a few books about defense, about, you know, match quarters defense and sort of the evolution of the game. And I was talking to him about coaching in high school football in Texas, because he had said, you know, coaching football in Texas, it's like you're hired to be fired, and that, you know, there's so much pressure that goes with coaching in that state that you're not really going to find in a lot of other states. So I was going to ask if that had been your experience, or maybe, you know, something that you had observed as a fan and having played in there, that is there an added pressure or an added responsibility to being a coach in Texas, more so maybe than other states in the country?
I would say in the most general sense, yes. Because, you know, we used to joke when I would tell people I played high school ball in Texas, you know, the next line to follow was, of course, you know, football is behind Baptist is the number two religion in the state. So I think, yes, there is an inherent pressure that goes along with the reputation of Texas football. And it's never been more amplified, and in my opinion, more, I don't, denigrated, I guess would be the right word, is when they came out with the series called Friday Night Tykes. And it was about youth league football. And it was completely, they were coaching, the parents and coaches in some leagues treat it like it's the freaking NFL. I mean, it's totally ridiculous. And I think a youth football coach's number one thing to do is to build a love for the game and an appreciation within the game of having fun, so that a young person is excited about coming back the next year or going to the next level. And if you can do that over time, what you find is that kids love the sport and want to come back, and they grow in the game because they're enjoying themselves. 70% of kids today, and this stat's been around since I first discovered it, maybe before, in 2010. That is, the 70% of kids in the U.S. stop playing youth sports by the age of 13. And the three most commonly cited reasons are overzealous parents, bad coaching, and specialization. In other words, kids that are told, oh, no, you got to play year-round baseball, you need to play year-round soccer, and so on and so forth. They get burned out. So, you know, I have a theory, and I think I've never really talked to any coaches about it. And I may get beat up for saying this, but I really believe, even starting at the youth level, my experience is that good coaches, you evaluate good how you want. Good coaches know they're good coaches. And I suspect most bad coaches know they're bad coaches. I think a lot of bad coaches tend to do things that validate their existence or their pursuit of success. And I think that when you develop great relationships with your players and you understand and love the game and love your players, the rest is going to kind of take care of itself. It's easy to win with great players, but it's not impossible to win without them. And I think that you win off the field and in more ways than on the scoreboard when you grow a kid's love for the game and you have great relationships and a fondness for team sports and love for your brothers on the team and things like that, as opposed to the fact that, you know, you go 13-0 and win the state championship. Although that's a great thing, I'm not knocking that. But I think, to get back to your original question, yes, the pressure in Texas because of reputation is huge, and because of the premier programs that we have here. I mean, when you look around, and you can fill in the blank with any, you know, whether it's Allen or Highland Park or any of the premier programs that have been, you know, powerhouses for a long time. It's just one of those things. I mean, it is what it is. It's a good, but there's equally good high school football in locations in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Florida. We didn't have quite as good across the board in the state of Kentucky for the time that I lived there. There was some good football there, but it wasn't as common as it is here.
Yeah, it definitely seems that premier stigma of high school football in Texas, or I shouldn't say stigma, but the talent, it makes youth programs sort of feeder programs for when they eventually reach that high school age. And I think a lot of coaches kind of take on that Vince Lombardi winning isn't everything, it's the only thing mentality that, you know, I think it's important to install competitiveness and winning at kids at an early age, but there's also a balancing act in teaching them sound fundamentals and I guess the character building aspect of the game.
Well, you know, there are many football coaches that have done wonderful things. I mean, Bobby Bowden was a stalwart in the game in terms of building relationship with players. I personally had a couple of guys that played for him, you know, on my podcast, and they talked glowingly of him. But I always refer back to, if you want to see about balancing, you know, character development and winning attitude, look no further than UCLA. I mean, John Wooden is probably the master of, you know, of the coaching style that I think anyone, if they profess to do that, can be more successful with that than being an autocrat.
Now, something that I thought was interesting in talking with you last week is that you had, and you alluded to this earlier, you spent a good amount of time recruiting for the Army All-American game, which was like the high school all-star game for a lot of kids who were ranked high across the nation. And you've had the chance to work with a lot of former NFL players and coaches who coach these kids leading up to the game. And you've since had them on your podcast, like Billy White Shoes Johnson or Anthony Munoz. And I'm curious, you know, when you work with premier talent like that and guys who have had not only made it to the highest level possible, but had great success, do you notice in having worked with them any sort of common trait that they all share that contributes to their success?
Work ethic.
Yeah.
Far and away. It's you know, you see there are kids out there that are humble by nature. Arch Manning, you know, look at him now. I mean, he's been recruited by anybody and everybody. If you listen to what he says, he's a pretty humble kid. You ever watch college basketball?
No.
Okay. Well, Gonzaga's been a powerhouse for a while, and they, you know, made it to the Elite Eight this time. And the kid that is their star power forward, Drew Timmy, is actually the grandson of my high school head football coach. And I didn't know that until I got back to Texas. My high school coach is still alive. I'm working on setting up a lunch date with him. When I heard Drew interviewed on TV, the questions were all leading about him, but all his answers were about his teammate and about the game and about his coaches. And I think that the two factors that you find with kids that are most successful, and this is a gross generalization, so under the heading of all generalizations are usually false. I think work ethic is the number one example factor that really carries kids through. And the second is a healthy degree of humility. But that humility is expressed in somewhat different ways for different kids. So it's kind of a personality thing. Some kids just are not fond of being in the limelight. Other kids are comfortable with it, but they still really talk about, you know, I just want to thank my coaches for giving me the opportunity, and we couldn't have done this without all the teammates and blah, blah, blah. And I think some people kind of see that on TV and they roll their eyes like, yeah, he's preaching the party line. But my experience is great kids start in great homes. And when you see kids like that, that have the work ethic without being told, here's what you've got to do. You know, only 2% of any athlete in any sport in high school is heavily recruited in the United States. And you can sit here and quote all the little minimal statistics all day long, but you can juxtapose that with guys who made it to the highest level who didn't fit any stereotype or norm. I mean, you know, Muggsy Bogues, was 5'3 or 5'6 or something like that, and dunked and played in the league in the NBA for 13 years. You know, nobody thought that, oh my goodness, his name just went right out of my head. Kid that used to play running back for the Patriots. Anyway, the point is he was a Division II football player, but he stood out on the Patriots.
Curtis Martin?
No, it wasn't Martin. If you said his name, I'll recognize him. But anyway, he was also the Division II Player of the Year 2 years in a row. So, I mean, it wasn't like he wasn't a good athlete.
Danny Woodhead. But,
yeah, I think it was Woodhead. Yeah. And so when you start looking at things that separate guys, and I think this is true in any sport, but in football, even more so, there are a crap ton of kids that have the natural gifts that God gave them and have a ton of talent. And they don't succeed either in college or in the NFL because they don't have the emotional makeup to be able to have the character and work ethic that it takes to achieve success. There are kids that are told, hey, kid, you know, enjoy playing high school ball because you ain't going to college. There's no way you're going to make it in the NFL. And a fact that's considered, but not very often. There's a model that was grown, probably became famous really in Canadian hockey, called LTAD, long-term athletic development. And in a nutshell, LTAD, the model says that for any chronological age that an athlete is at, their physiological development can be either 3 years less or 3 years more than their chronological age. So a 13-year-old could have the body and talent and physical stamina of a 10-year-old or a 16-year-old. And you see it all the time in sports, in different sports. The one exception probably is gymnasts, because gymnasts tend to blossom early because of all the things they have to do. So gymnasts are in a kind of a category of their own. But there's almost any high school team you see in the nation will have some kid on the freshman team that's a super stud at the age of 15 who may be bigger and more developed and faster and stronger than everybody and maybe shaving already. But by the time he gets to be a senior, he's an average football player because he developed earlier than within that model than the normal kid did, versus the kid that, you know, it's like so many people rip soccer for the fact that they have all these club teams. The European model is way different than the U.S. model, but it's starting to be prevalent here where a kid gets identified early on. Well, the reality is I've heard premier soccer coaches say we suck at talent identification. Because you can't tell a kid who's 5 years old, hey, you need to get on this club team and develop until you're 18 or 20 and then play pro ball. The kid may not even want to play soccer by the time he's 10. And that applies to any sport. So I think my first answer was work ethic is number one. And I think humility to some degree blends with that work ethic. And I mean, you know, Robin Sharma says all the time, in order to get what the 5% have, you got to be able to do and willing to do what the 5% won't do, or what the 95% right. won't right. do. And it's, you know, it in the world of college recruiting, if 2% of athletes in this nation are heavily recruited, being in the 98 percentile in most things is not negative. But if you want to be a college athlete, everybody looks at it as being negative because, oh, I'm not one of the 2% highly recruited. Well, you know, I mean, look at Ndamukong Suh played soccer his whole life until he started playing high school, I think his senior year of high school football. You know, you look at a guy like Ted Cottrell, who was Bruce Smith's mentor at Buffalo. I mean, Ted was a track star in high school. His dad told him, he says, boy, don't play college or don't play football. You're no good. His dad told him that. His brother was a superstar. And he ended up getting drafted by the Falcons, you know, and playing a year in the NFL and then had a 40-plus year coaching career. So it's there are a number of factors that and it varies from person to person. But I think work ethic and humility are probably the two things inherent to most great athletes who make it, regardless of to what level of success.
And seeing a lot of high school athletes at the time who went on to play in the NFL, were there any that you saw in that game that had that emotional makeup at that young age that you weren't surprised to see them playing in the NFL years later?
Probably the one that jumped into my head was Andrew Luck. His was like that. I remember Adrian Peterson was the number one high school recruit coming out of the state of Texas. And I was standing probably 10 feet from the podium where he was when he made his selection and pulled up the OU hat and put it on and got booed out of the stadium because we were in San Antonio, Texas. He was, he had the work ethic and superior athletic talent. But he was also driven by a little bit different situation because his dad was in prison. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, there's unique factors all the way around. But Andrew Luck really jumps out at me. There have been a ton of others since I've been disconnected from the All-American game. I mean, I saw most of them that went to college and have since gone to the NFL, which had absolutely nothing to do with me. I saw them when they came to, you know, FBU camps that I was running. And, you know, I still keep in touch, you know, on a tangential basis with the guys who do that, still have contacts and get to see stuff all the time. But it's there were many times that it didn't surprise me that the young men that I met at these camps were able to propel themselves to success at some level. And you wouldn't necessarily have thought by looking at them that that would be the case, or by being around them a little bit. There was just a kid. I can remember seeing him at the camp. I can't remember. We were at Round Rock, Texas, and we ran a camp there. And there's a kid named Logan Bonner who just finished his career as the quarterback for Utah State. And he was at Arkansas State before that. He traveled with the old Arkansas State head coach when he went to Utah State. And, I mean, Logan, I know his dad, kept in touch with him throughout his college career, was very successful. But I wouldn't necessarily have picked him to be that level of successful when I saw him as a 10th grader at the football camp. But it was that work ethic and that desire that propelled him forward and gave him the opportunity, and he seized it and made the most of it.
Yeah, I think it's definitely hard to get a gauge on a person at that age, so young. But, I mean, the guys you mentioned, you know, AP and Luck, I mean, they were both great players. So it definitely tells a lot, and those were, you know, definitely good choices to pop out in your head. Now, what I originally had reached out to you about last week was your involvement in Major League Football. First, can you tell the audience what it is and how you got involved in the league?
Yeah. One of the coaches that I worked with extensively at FBU was former Florida and NFL wide receiver, Wes Chandler. And Wes and I kept in touch. And when I was working, he called me and said, "Hey, I'd like you to listen to a pitch, and we're getting involved with this league." So I got brought on board. Excuse me. And when they first got started, MLFB failed three times, and I won't go through the litany of things that they've had, but it's been you couldn't write a stranger script for the stuff that they've gone through. So I got involved initially because of my professional association with Wes Chandler. I was brought on as the director of tryout camps. And so I ran over a course of several years, I ran professional pro day tryout camps for guys, some guys that had never played college ball, other guys that had just been cut from NFL teams. So I can remember running a camp at Linfield Christian School out in Temecula, California. And we had a guy show up who had just been cut by the Browns, a tight end. Other guys, you know, we had a guy down in Florida when I ran a camp down there 2 or 3 years ago, who literally was a truck driver and parked an 18-wheeler in the parking lot for the tryout camp when he came to try out, pulled his gear out of the back of the truck. So the genesis of this was to come up with a developmental football league that would allow post-collegiate players to develop their game to the point where they would competitive to potentially sign with an NFL team. Because what we've seen, and this, I'm not speaking from experience, I've never coached or played in the NFL, but I'm relating what I have heard from multiple former players and coaches, in that over the last decade and a half or so, we've seen a steady decline in the preparedness of college players to step into the NFL game, particularly when it comes to the speed of the game. Mm-hmm. And I give you a small for instance. If you happen to have an offensive coordinator that runs a pro style offense, like Mac Jones coming out of University of Alabama, or Joe Burrow coming out of LSU, and you are very successful at that level of college football, you oftentimes can transition into the pros. And even at the most complex position, which certainly is quarterback, you can step in and begin to be effective because you've learned the skills that you need for in terms of, you know, pre-snap reads and so on and so forth. But if you're an offensive or defensive lineman, there are certain techniques that are played at the college level that don't necessarily translate to the pro game. And sometimes the styles of offense in particular that they play at the college with all of these RPO offense, the, you know, the run pass option offenses, it tends to hide weaknesses, particularly in offensive linemen and sometimes in running backs and defensive backs. So some of those guys come forward out of the college game and they're just not quite ready. And if they don't go into a system where they're given the opportunity or that the organization has the time to allow them to grow internally, they get cut and they fall by the wayside. So Major League Football was developed as a developmental league. And I don't know if they'd appreciate me describing it like this, but there have been discussions, you know, minor league baseball has been successful for years. When MLFB came into existence, the idea was we do not want to compete or be adversarial with the NFL. We are here to try and augment player talent and get guys ready to try and play in the NFL. And in some cases, maybe the CFL. So the goal for the MLFB, our team, our corporate team, is to set up teams that play competitive football, but that are geared toward player and coach development. So when you look at the three choices they've made thus far for coaches, the three named head coaches so far are Jerry Glanville, Terry Shea, and Bill Connelly. Of those three, Glanville has probably the most overt name recognition, even though Shea has coached in the NFL. He was the head coach at Rutgers in his last head coaching job, I think. And then Bill Connelly has a tremendous resume, but he's never been a head coach. So, you know, whoever the fourth coach is, all of those guys will have the responsibility of bringing guys in. And I'm sure initially there'll be guys that they've worked with in past assignments. And we not only want to develop players, but we want to develop coaches. So it'd be a great opportunity for a kid who's a GA at the University of Oklahoma to come into MLFB, let's say, and work under the wing of an experienced defensive coordinator, maybe as a secondary backs coach, and, you know, grow his stock and then move to a college team or to an NFL team, maybe player development or player personnel. So the idea is it's a developmental league that is meant to complement the NFL, but not be adversarial or competitive with the NFL. And it's another avenue in addition to the two leagues that we'll see hopefully develop, the USFL, which starts this year pretty soon, and the XFL, which is supposedly going to start next year.
It seems to me that anytime there's talks about like a new league, that it makes more sense to make a list of things to not do as opposed to make a list of things to do. So for you, what would be your personal number one of things not to do?
I think in the context of the fact that investing in professional sports is probably considered one of the most risky ventures you can do. And below the very top tier, in this case, below the NFL, that has never been more true. So I think the number one thing we learned, and we learned it from the failure of the XFL and from the American Alliance for Football, the AAF, Alliance for American Football. We learned from both those leagues. They both really went over the top in terms of paying their staffs and the players. It's one thing to play professionally, but when the league minimum, you know, and I think the league minimum in the NFL is, it used to be $420,000 for a practice squad member, but it's
about the same.
it's different now. But anyway, no, I take that back. It was $420,000 for the low for the first year player who made the active roster. I think the practice squad was about $120K, but it's more than that now. But if you want to compete at that level, you've got to have very deep pockets and a very long bank account. And most startup leagues don't have that luxury. I mean, we'll see. The USFL has all the backing of Fox as their TV contract, so maybe that'll work out for them. I don't know. But the number one thing is you need to do diligence and say, okay, we're going to start slow and we're going to pick up speed as we go. And part of that is to incentivize the players by paying them amount that makes them a paid professional athlete, gives them the experience to develop it and better themselves in their game. And then, you know, hopefully some incentives along the way that keep it going and enable them to make more money as they go. But the idea is not to make everybody rich. It's to give them the foundation to grow their game and improve as an athlete and a person, and hopefully achieve that level, that next level of success and go to the NFL. Paying people too much, hiring too many folks, trying to carry huge rosters, traveling when it's not, you know, the USFL's model may work out well. They're playing all their games in Birmingham, so they're going to avoid a whole lot of overhead travel costs, you know, and that may be a recipe for success. Who knows? We'll have to see. But, the fundamentals of football inside the game are all kind of the same. You know, I mean, regardless of what style of offense or defense you run, or, you know, whether you have a guy with his hand in the dirt in a 9 technique, or whether he's playing a 7 technique as a defensive end, all of that kind of stuff is all kind of coaches adapting their scheme to the players and the talent that they draw through the draft. I think it is as much a recipe for failure on the administrative and financial side as it is for the game on the field. But all of that said, you still got to put a good product on the field, because that's what fans are going to pay to see.
You have any rule changes?
We are going to follow pretty much NFL rules. There are some things being examined in terms of special team play that could change, but for the most part, the structure and execution of the game is going to be more along in line with the NFL game.
So you mentioned, obviously, that the USFL is going to be kicking off this weekend and the XFL allegedly is going to be kicking off next year. So this may be a better question for the marketing department, but how do you persuade a viewer to tune in to Major League Football as opposed to watching the USFL or watching the XFL when that time eventually comes?
Well, I think we're working on, the chief marketing officer and his vice president and the guys that will be on their team are working on, certainly exploiting social media and having a great website. Our website is up. It's currently under revision. It's now, you know, they're adding to it as we go. And the big thing they're looking at is trying to, really incorporate human interest stories. And be able to, you know, show video of guys going through tryouts, interviews with kids that have struggled to make teams or that had an opportunity in college and didn't have it come to fruition and are trying to reinvigorate their careers. So I think, one, we've got to market from the standpoint of, being able to show that human side of the sport and why we want to provide guys with another opportunity to succeed. And then let them take that opportunity. Eric Thomas, the guy they call the hip hop preacher, one of my favorite quotes of his is, he says, "You've got to seize the opportunity of a lifetime within the lifetime of that opportunity." Mm-hmm. And I think that, that there's no more truth in that than with something like MLFB. When a kid who maybe had success up to a certain level, but for whatever reason didn't make the pros, gets another opportunity, we want to present that in such a way that it really amplifies the goodness in this kid and what he's going to gain from the opportunity and how he takes that and runs with it. And I think, if we can put a good product on the field, that'll be 90% of the battle. But I think that the human element will be huge. And I think all three leagues will be trying to do that. The XFL, I think, is a little more gimmicky. And I don't say that to be negative. I just think that that's kind of their DNA. It'll be interesting to see what The Rock and his crew decide to do with it. Whereas the USFL goes back a little more to its roots, and we'll see Brian Woods is the guy that used to do the spring league. He's kind of the mastermind behind that. So we'll have to see, you know, what they do. But for us, it's going to be all about growing the opportunity and helping guys develop and achieve success, you know, on both on and off the field.
Now, you've had the chance to talk to a lot of players and coaches who have obviously been in the NFL, but who also went through other upstart leagues as well. Are there any words of wisdom that or advice that they've passed on to you that you think would be good to implement for a long-term success strategy for the league?
I think that from an overall resource perspective and talking to a couple of coaches that were involved with NFL Europe, I think NFL Europe had a great, it was a great idea. It was a great product. In fact, arguably NFL Europe was intended to be the developmental league.
Right.
But it, I don't think that Europe as a continent and all the countries in Europe were necessarily ready for American football at that point, as much as they may have maybe now with all of the, you know, the more and more each year seems like we have more games over in, you know, Wembley Stadium or, you know, in Estadio Azteca down in Mexico or whatever. So I think probably it is to be very smart with your resources, and that includes your personnel resources, to put the very best product on the field and allow the guys to succeed within the game in such a way that, you know, amplifies both their success as well as the league's, because you can throw a bunch of things against the wall and see what sticks, or you can take all those lessons learned from the former XFL, USFL, the AAF, NFL Europe, and say, okay, if we don't start with any other discussion, let's take a look at what didn't work and definitely avoid those pitfalls. And I think to some extent, we've kind of done that. I mean, we have guys in our, you know, in our working staff that have been involved in NFL Europe at various levels, or were. And I think that we're doing that. And I think that that's a good way to go. So it's not so much that this one idea is going to be the panacea to make it succeed as much as it is. We certainly know what, where all the pitfalls are, at least some of them. And if we do our best to avoid those, hopefully we'll get further down the road this time.
When are you trying to get the kickoff date?
As it stands right now, the projected launch time would be during the month of July.
Okay.
There you can read the various latest investment news on the website. I just saw another one here. I'm trying to see. Let's see. They just put up on April 6th. Frank Murtha, who is our president and CEO, announced that they received another term sheet for $7.5 million in an equity line investment from a different institutional investor. So, you know, those types of things are driving the timing. I can tell you when I was at the last planning meeting week before last, we had the executive management team and most of the senior staff there, either directors or executive vice presidents of each function. And my job specifically within the league is director of field operations. So I'm responsible for making sure that everybody's ready to go and things are right for training camp to run for the projected four teams that we're going to start with. And then eventually I'll be overseeing the standard for those teams when they run their own pro days and training camps to make sure we're consistent throughout the league. So we're projecting a July start, you know, and we're certainly, everyone is committed to playing cleats in the dirt this year. You know, we are going to get the league launched, but the specific timing of the launch will probably be a little bit in fluctuation based on the timing of receipt of the rest of the funding that we need. So it was good news, you know, before the end of the year, we had a $5 million term sheet line of credit. And then this recent one that I just read about. So the money is in place. I mean, you know, those of us that are on the staff are currently being paid. So that's a good thing. And the idea is now we have to go forward. I just spoke to our equipment manager today. We have all of our equipment stored in a warehouse in San Antonio. And, you know, we're going through setting up all the team's equipment so that eventually it'll be boxed up and sent out. And when the teams report and start going through all of their physicals and everything, it'll all be done and we can hand all that out. So all of those kind of things are in process. We've just got to get to the point where, you know, we start actually recruiting guys and bringing them in.
I think you should recruit Johnny Manziel.
I think Manziel, I don't quote me on this, but I think Manziel and Terrell Owens are both playing for FCF. It's fan-controlled football. I think they signed contracts to play for that league. It's a seven-on-seven arena league football where the fans call the plays.
It's full contact?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's actually another seven-on-seven league right now that's full contact that they don't have pads.
Wow.
Yeah, it's called the A7 Football League. Anybody, you can go on YouTube and look at their games. Yeah, it's a pretty interesting concept. They don't play on a full length field. It's modified, obviously, similar to what you see in arena football. But yeah, stuff like that I think can make a league stand out where you don't see the same style playing the NFL that can make a person turn their head twice and say, "Oh, I'll check it out." But yeah, Go ahead. That fan-controlled league, I've seen some stuff, but I've never actually done a deep dive into what the league is or how it operates or what any of the goals are.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I was up, I used to run a sports academy up in Erie, Pennsylvania. And my head coach and I, Kurt Barber, who's a former USC and NFL linebacker, there's an Arena 2 team in Erie called the Erie Explosion, and they're very competitive. They've won several championships. And we did their when they come into their training camp prior to the season, I mean, they come in expected to be in full shape, ready to go. And we ran their warmups for them their first week of training when they went into their training camp. And it was interesting to go watch. I had a coach that I worked with on my staff at the academy who played defensive back for them. He played at Slippery Rock University in Pennsylvania, Division II. And it's a good product. It's a good level of football. And a lot of local guys have a lot of success and really enjoy, you know, playing the game long into their, you know, what would be considered their probably over the hill years. But it's a good brand of football. At least it was when I was there. And it's very fan oriented. There's a lot of stuff goes on in the stadium and in the stands during the game. And of course, you know, half the fans tend to imbibe while they're there. So there's a lot of drunkenness stuff too. So that's a little crazy sometimes, but it's a lot of fun.
And this was like a minor league arena team?
Yeah, they had, it was kind of an unofficial arena too. You know, the arena league basically dissolved. I mean, when I was in Kentucky at Fort Knox, and then after I retired, we had the Louisville Fire, which was an arena team, and it had a whole crap ton of owners. But Louisville, as great a college football or college sports town as it is, they couldn't sustain the team at being competitive. And then, of course, arena kind of went downhill. But there's enough of these Arena 2 teams that have survived that, I mean, it's a pretty decent level of football. And I don't know how they're doing or how they did this past year, but it was fun to watch. I mean, we had a guy for the Erie Explosion who played center who we trained him individually for his preseason workouts and training. And when I first saw him, I said, how is this guy not in the NFL? He was, when we started training him, he was 6'8", 370 pounds. And he was not fat. I mean, he was just a massive hunk of man. And he was a good football player, but not necessarily of the caliber that he could have turned his size into, you know, an NFL career. But he drove for the Pennsylvania Department of Transportation and had a great job and loved playing football and was happy. And, you know, I it was great to be involved with him and, you know, see him enjoy the game.
Yeah. I love hearing stories like that about guys that, you know, you're never going to hear about, but they're involved in the game well past their playing days. And I think speaking of Manziel, I think he was actually playing in the indoor league, which might be what you're referring to, like a second incarnation, although it doesn't have anything to do with the original arena league. But it does seem like that offshoot brand of football does have its appeal that will always stick around in some form or another.
I think so. I mean, you know, I think as long as there are businessmen out there willing to spend or organize the capital to do so, and they can link up with athletes that are willing to train and put their bodies on the line, because certainly some of those guys are old enough that they're assuming risk.
To say the least.
There'll always be some level of pro football. And I would love it if all three of these spring leagues survive. I really would. We're just going to have to wait and see. And to some extent, we're all kind of fighting for the same group of guys, but most people don't realize how many people there are out there who want to play pro football. And in some cases, very talented guys. I mean, you know, when you look at the structure of an NFL roster at 53 and then whatever it is, 10 on the travel squad. Beyond that, there are a crap ton of guys that get cut every year. And you know, we plan to operate once we go through our draft and our cuts, we plan to operate with rosters of 50 players. I think the USFL, I spoke to one of my coaching buddies who is on one of the staffs with the USFL, and I think they're going with a roster of 38 players, their final rosters. Really? So they're a little bit smaller, but you know, there's a lot of guys out there. And I certainly think that the player personnel guys believe there are plenty to go around, even if all three leagues survive.
That's a throwback to whenever they only had 33 guys on a roster.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of cool. I wonder if there's any people that are going to be playing two ways. Probably not, but it'd be cool.
I don't know. That's a good question. You would likely think not. I mean, even though, you know, like, every once in a while you'll see somebody do it in the NFL, you know, a defensive back who is a receiver or was in college or vice versa or something like that. But you don't see it very often. I mean, I can remember back in the day, a good friend of mine who's down in Austin, Bill Bradley's former Philadelphia Eagle. Mm-hmm. He's in the Texas High School Football Hall of Fame. He's in the Philadelphia or the UT Ring of Honor. I mean, he's a legend in Texas football. And when he played for the Eagles, he actually kicked and punted and returned kicks and punts. And I've never found in my searches, not in-depth deep dives, but I've done some preliminary searches. I've never found evidence of anybody in the NFL that's ever done that was both a kick specialist and a return specialist. He's the only one that I know of.
That's fascinating. Actually, Joe Zagorski. Do you know Joe?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's actually writing a book on Bill Bradley.
Is he really?
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, well, that's fascinating.
I hope he's had the time. I'll have to contact Joe and let him out, because I'm going to get Bill. We had plans to get – Bill was scheduled to be on my podcast last year when the XFL stood up. And at the last minute, June Jones was the head coach of the Houston team. Mm-hmm. And Ted Cottrell was his defensive coordinator. And Chris Miller, former NFL quarterback, was his OC. And he called Bill and asked him to come coach defensive backs and linebackers. And he did that. And we had to cancel the interview. But Bill – I've been out with Bill in multiple social settings and watched him at camps. He's a fascinating human being, and he's an absolute joy to be around. He's a great guy.
You should also get your high school football coach on your show.
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I hope to. I mean, I recently there were four main coaches when I was in high school. Jerry Bishop was the head coach, and he is a legend still. Here, I live in Sherman, Texas. He was a small college All-American at Austin College here in Sherman, and some of his records stood for 50 years before they were broken. He was our head coach. And then there's a guy named Doug Moore, who is still down in Richardson, who is still around. He was our offensive line coach. He was also the head baseball coach at the high school. And then one of the coaches has passed. And then there's another guy I haven't managed to run down yet named Don Snowden, who was my track coach, and he was the defensive backs coach. And our quarterbacks coach. So yeah, it would be cool to get those guys on and relive some memories. I was just happy that Coach Bishop even remembered me. So you know, I mean, he coached for a long time. So and we had some pretty decent players come out of Pierce that went and played Division I football. I played 1 year of NAIA football, and that was it. So you know, it is what it is.
Do you know of a guy in the Texas high school? Actually, he's in the high school football Hall of Fame. Generally, his nickname was the Sugarland Express. Ken Hall.
And I've heard the Sugarland Express before, but I was kind of tangentially aware of the legend, but I didn't know his name.
Yeah, he played in the 50s, predominantly, you know, out of a single wing, but he has a total of 11,232 career rushing yards in high school, which is actually even more impressive because apparently those teams were so dominant that he'd even play in the second half of games a lot of times. Yeah.
Yeah, that's crazy when you're do you remember, by any chance, you remember Chris Leak, who played quarterback at
Florida? Yeah.
Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was in the All-American Bowl. And I remember coming down the, I was coming down the elevator in the hotel in San Antonio, the guys were getting ready to go over to practice. And Chris was in the elevator with the guy who was playing center on the same team. And he said, the guy, I asked the kid on the center, I said, what has stood out to you the most since you've been down here? And he said, Coach, no kidding. He said, I have dominated at every level of football I played throughout my life. And he goes, down here, I'm lucky to be as good as the guy across from me. He goes, these guys are at a whole nother level. This is the best of the best. He goes, the guy I'm snapping the ball to, and he kind of nodded over at Chris. He said, he threw for like 13,000 yards when he was in high school. Cause I think Leak, if I remember right, he never lost a game in high school. I think he played somewhere in Virginia. Anyway, we get to the bottom of it. We're at the lobby and the elevator door opens up and said, and Chris had made a comment, a very humble comment, but he turned to his center and he goes, and it was 15,000 yards. and it's just kind of, you know, when you hear about records like that, I mean, and you can still be humble and make that correction. I'm not knocking Chris, but right. You know, even as much talent as he had in high school and the program he played at was a premier program. Some would argue he only enjoyed marginal success at University of Florida.
And well, of course, I actually grew up 45 minutes away from Gainesville. So I was surrounded constantly by Gators, and you know, Gator football was always broadcasted here. And he's a guy that I think kind of got quickly forgotten about because Tebow came in and also had great success and instantly so. Because I actually forgot when I was thinking about this a while back, Chris was actually the starting quarterback when the Gators beat Ohio State. I guess it was 2005 or 6. I thought Tebow had won all the championships while he was there, but Chris Leak was actually the starter and Tebow was the backup. I guess Tebow was a freshman. But yeah, I actually forgot, you know, really how much of a standout he was. And like you say, you know, he didn't break the record books when he was in college, but nonetheless, when you're starting for a national championship team, that has to sit, you know, speak volumes.
Well, and you know, you can't necessarily, I mean, I don't know what Chris is doing today. I certainly hope he's successful in whatever endeavor he's in, but it's, I mean, you know, I mean, most people don't realize what a man child Tebow is. I mean, he's a beast physically. And, you know, I think his game got better and more refined as he took over and played and ultimately, you know, led the team. And, you know, I don't fault Chris. It happens all the time. I mean, you look at any, and what has made it bad, and it's, you could do a whole nother podcast on this, but it's not real historical. If we could look back on what we're going through now between NIL and the transfer portal, mm-hmm. long-term team loyalty for 4 years in a college is almost unheard of anymore. And that's a gross exaggeration. If you look at the 85 scholarship athletes at every major D1 college, I'm sure the vast majority are probably four-year athletes, even if they're not starters. But you see more and more guys. In fact, this is funny. When I was interviewing Anthony Munoz and Jim McNally, you know, Anthony was talking about they were at an event, and, you know, he asked his kid, why did you pick this school? And, you know, you usually hear answers like, well, I want an opportunity to compete for a national championship. I felt like I was going to be able to get on the field and get playing time soonest. I really love the coaching staff. And this kid's answer without hesitation was, I want to go here to build my brand. you know.
Yeah, so it's becoming a bigger part of the new generation of athletes, no doubt about it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think in some ways it's good. I'm all for kids getting paid for their name, image, and likeness. But I think that the long run is going to show us that there are going to be some detrimental things. And the transfer portal and the timing of it is kind of almost an aside. You know, the transfer portal is an animal in and of itself.
Well, you actually brought this up when you were talking to Billy White Shoes about a lot of wolves dressed in sheep's clothing will come out from this. When is season 3 launching?
I am going to, I have a critical tactical decision to make. The project I'm working on right now is called Changing Youth Sports. And I've gone out and been able to recruit. At this point, I think I've got 12, what I'm calling allies of change. And these are nationally recognized or internationally recognized folks that I simply want to become an evangelist for. My goal is to try and change youth sports from the inside out. I firmly believe that youth sports and certainly some other extracurricular activities, but sports in particular, provides a platform for kids to learn social and life skills in a way that nothing else teaches them. And I think that we need more parent engagement, more coaching education. And I think in our society today, as polarized as we are, sports tend to bring people together. So to answer your question, I had planned to do season 3 starting sometime after the draft, but I'm really weighing the opportunities because I do plan to do a podcast called Changing Youth Sports. And I think what I'm going to end up doing is getting that one off the ground and continuing to do some selected episodes for the good of the game, and then see how this other project takes off and go from there. So I don't have a firm date yet, but I'm definitely going to, sometime before the fall, I'm going to launch Changing Youth Sports podcast. And the goal there will be to basically interview. And I'm going to do two series. I'm going to do one by myself, which I do short 12 to 18 minute segments talking about specific topics. And then I'm going to follow that by interviewing a guest talking about the same topic and what they bring to the table to help promote or amplify that particular aspect of the game. Like, for instance, being a multi-sport athlete or sports sampling. Those are very closely related topics. So we'll see how it goes, but I'm really excited about it. I mean, John O'Sullivan of Changing the Game Project's on board. We've got 241 Sports and their organization. I should have had the list in front of me, and I really didn't plan on talking about it that much, but it's I'm excited about it. The only thing I'm weighing right now is having to, you know, obviously doing that while I'm trying to do MLFB is going to get pretty intense, because once we do go to camp, it'll be, you know, I'll be it, depending on where we do camp, it's being looked at in different places right now, but where we end up settling, I'll be there for 3 to 4 weeks straight. So I don't want to overcommit and do both an injustice. So we'll see.
You've obviously had a lot of high profile guys on your show, guys who have had success in the league and also other areas in life. If you could have one dream guest on your show, living or deceased, who would you like to have on?
Probably either Herm Edwards or Tony Dungy. I'm a huge fan of both for slightly different reasons. I know guys who played for both. Both men have very balanced and measured approaches to the game that I absolutely respect as coaches. And although I used to actually employ a player, a former NFL player who played for Herm Edwards and didn't like him, the majority of guys I've talked to that played for either of those guys speak volumes about them. So I think probably those were the two that popped into my head. I mean, I've had a chance to have conversations with some really heady guys, and it's been a ton of fun. I would also love to transition into getting some more recent players, like, you know, Coach Charlie Collins, who's out in California, is the head coach at Hollywood High, Oaks Christian. He's trained Larry Fitzgerald, TJ Houshmandzadeh, Ocho Cinco. I mean, a number of high profile split ends. And I've talked to him about having some of those guys on. I think it would, as far as name recognition, because the reality is there are certainly fans and kids specifically out there who aren't necessarily going to recognize Anthony Munoz or Bruce Smith, despite the fact that they're in the Hall of Fame. A lot of people don't remember Billy White Shoes Johnson, not because he's not memorable, but because they're young enough that they didn't see him play. So it was special to me because I watched these guys. I mean, I was playing high school or college football either shortly after them or while they were playing. And that made it real special for me. But yeah, probably those two would be on my short list of dream guests. I mean, there's a ton of other guys, but you know, when you look at, I started for the good of the game to talk about football insights and life skills. And I branched over into relationships. And those are two very niche things. We don't necessarily talk about scheme. We don't talk X's and O's. And to me, that's the side of football that nobody explores much. And one of my dream guests is off my bucket list. I mean, I interviewed Bill Curry, and not only is he a masterful storyteller, but he's just such a down-to-earth guy. And I mean, I love to meet him in person sometime. I've never met him in person, and I've, you know, but he was a wonderful interview and just really thoughtful guys who, you know, and when you look at the list of guys he played with on the Colts and the Packers, it's like, holy crap. It's like a laundry list of Hall of Famers. And, I mean, you know, he snapped the football to Earl Morrill and, oh my goodness.
Super Bowl III.
Yeah. Bart Starr was one of his best friends up until Bart passed, and he still is friends with Cherry Starr, Bart's wife. I mean, you know, those, so there's, you know, the association and the relationships that he had with all those players were Johnny Unitas was the player I was trying to fish out of my memory. So, you know, when you go back and you're able to, you know, especially from a history standpoint, when you're able to talk to guys and not only watched or coached, but played with those guys, it's just a tremendous gift. And I love it.
To close off, do you want to tell people where they can listen to the show and where they can follow you online?
Absolutely. I appreciate the opportunity. My website is forthegoodofthegame.com. I am in the process of altering my YouTube channel because the way I named my episodes, it turned out to backfire on me a little bit. I do have a YouTube channel called For the Good of the Game. It's a little bit hard to get to. It's kind of clunky because of the titles. But my audio podcasts are on all the major platforms, you know, Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, and so on. And it's forthegoodofthegame.com. And like I said, the website, everything is available through that as well. So, and I encourage anybody that's interested in the developmental side to check out mlfb.com. And that's the website that will continue to grow and be updated as the league comes to fruition.
Yeah, I'll put all the links in the description. John, this was a lot of fun, man. I enjoyed listening to pretty much all the avenues that you've explored with football and your journey within the game, man. I'm really looking forward to see Major League Football take off, and I encourage everyone to check out the podcast. So I'm grateful that you took the time. Thank you.
Well, I love what you do. I've listened to pieces of multiple different episodes, and I really think that you capture a lot of things that some fans don't necessarily consider or think about that are nuggets that are really insightful. So continue good luck with the podcast, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to be on.
Yeah, likewise, man. We'll do it again sometime.
Okay, take care.
Take it easy.